Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Rod Blackhurst. Now, Rod is the director of the new movie, Blood for Dust. It's out on VOD theatrical now. We'll talk about this in a second, but I have a lot of things I want to talk to Rod about, so this is very exciting. Thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Like, very, very stoked to be here.
All right, so I want to go back in your career. Let's go back to the beginning because, or maybe not the beginning, but earlier on, because you have some interesting stuff from early on in your career that you wrote and co-directed that was on Funny or Die, and I want to trace the evolution of going from Funny or Die to horror shorts. To this movie, which is I would describe it as kind of a Western neo-noir. It's a great kind of low budget neo-noir crime drama thriller. But it's just very different in tone from some of the other stuff that you've done. So let's go through Rod's career. Rod, how did you get started making movies? And what were you doing 10 years ago?
10 years ago, I was probably making some Funny or Die short films with, and these were very like crass, very, very, very not safe for work comedy shorts with Dave Franco and Chris Mintz-Plasse, who most people know as McLovin from Superbad. The reality is that, like, as a filmmaker, I would make anything I could, and some of that was finding willing, excited collaborators. And I had randomly met Dave Franco's childhood friend in line at a concert in Los Angeles when I was living there. And my wife and I had an extra ticket to the concert. It was a friend of ours from Denver who was a no-name musician at the time. Well, I say no-name, God bless him. Like, he's probably, if he ever hears this, like, he would probably say he was not a no-name. He's not a no-name. He's a very well-known musician now. His name is Nathaniel Ratliff. But at the time, Nathaniel was playing like these little rooms as a solo artist. Anyway, I met Dave Franco's childhood best friend in line behind us. He didn't have a ticket. We had an extra ticket. And Brian kind of mentioned that, like, you know, he and his buddy wanted to make some short films. And I had some camera equipment and some experience, and I'd made other random and weird things in my life. And so I was like, oh my gosh, I love this. Like, I want to make these things. And so we just went and made them. I think that, like, but generally speaking, like, I grew up without a television. I loved movies. Movies were so important in my growth. I mean, as well as music. But I would just try to make anything I could. And I would also try to walk through any door that I could find that got cracked open. And that was true, like, no matter what industry or what creative work or what thing it was, is I was like, if there was a room I could walk into and, like, plant a flag, I would try to do it and learn from it, grow from it, see what else it could lead to. The crazy thing about making those Funny or Die short films, which was like around 2011, 2012, is that one, when I met, when I went to talk to Amanda Knox, who I made a documentary about for Netflix, I distinctly remember, like, somebody in her friend group or her family group being like, what have you made that would would give you the right to make this documentary about Amanda? And I remember thinking, like, well, I'm just going to be very honest. Like, I was, you know, 21 or 31 at the time. I was like, I've made these, like, very lewd, suggestive, like, comedy shorts and I made some other, like, music videos and, like, commercials, but I hadn't made anything that would substantiate me being a documentary filmmaker or the person she would trust her story to. But I showed her those Dave Franco short films, and I'd like to believe that that's what convinced her to sit down opposite me and talk to me. But it was just like, you make what you could, make what you can. And I love everything. I love movies. I love storytelling. So, I like all genres, and yes, like, Blood for Dust is it's a neo-Western noir crime thriller. Like, I want to make those. I also want to make every movie that Denis Villeneuve directs. Like, that, if I could, I would just, like, I would just like to steal the next script he has or has been given, and I would like to make that movie, because there isn't a movie he's made that I don't love. So, I don't know. Yeah, it's, you know, life is weird, and the artist's past is weird. I mean, in the 2000s, I toured with a rock band for 4 years. I wasn't in the band, but I was originally the t-shirt guy, or as they call the cotton tech. But when I joined the band as a I joined the band on tour as a Cotton Tech, I didn't know any of them, and I had asked their management at the time, well, can I bring my video camera out and can I make things for them? And they were like, yeah, sure, like sure, kid, you know, like bring your camera. But I just made the things I could, and here I am today. And all those experiences have been awesome and wonderful, and they definitely have like helped me figure out more of what I love and what I want to do. But I'm never going to dismiss them. I had an interview the other day with this legendary film producer. I'm going to draw a blank on his name right now, but he has this company, Broken Road. He's made like 40 to 80 films that everybody would know the name of. And he asked me this question, and I was like, man, yes, because he could see this in my experience too. And I was like, you know what, dude? I love things. I feel like it would be so limiting to just be a filmmaker that makes one thing. And I'm never going to do that. Although I think people do like to have a filmmaker fit into a box because it helps them understand them and like figure out like, you know, what the tie is that binds them together. But, mm-hmm. And I do have one thing I like more than others for sure. And I would like to make those things, but I would love to make a broad comedy someday. I'll probably never get the chance, but like, I would like to make people laugh like we used to make people laugh.
You say you have one thing you like in particular. What is that thing?
Oh man, it's like Blade Runner, Terminator 2, Alien. If there was whatever's in the middle of that Venn diagram, you know, and I think that like, yeah, it's like, you know, these grounded science fiction, elevated science fiction, genre films that are big and epic and fantastic. I mean, those movies were so important and seminal to me. And, I think about them all the time still to this day. I mean, I would like to make movies in that vein. I mean, you know, and there are movies being made like that now, you know. I mean, Children of Men is a good example of that, like some, or Arrival, you know, Denis Villeneuve mm-hmm. film. Like, so I mean, that's what I want to make. That's what I'm gonna make. And Blood for Dust is not those things, but Blood for Dust is also the movie we could make. And so I think that goes back to what the answer to your first question is. You make the things you can make, and you make the things you can coalesce support and enthusiasm behind and other like-minded souls, and then you go make that, and then you keep trying to reach for what you want to be doing.
Yeah, it's interesting. And so the Funny or Die thing is interesting just for me as an outside observer, because it's one of the few places in the last 20 or 30 years where there was a real repository of short film. I mean, like, short film I wouldn't say it's a dying art form, because it's not like it was ever, you know, enormously popular to begin with. But short films are a great place for people to learn basic filmmaking skills, to make those connections. And I'm curious, just one last question on this is when you were working on these, what did you learn while doing them that you could then bring into the rest of your career?
Yeah, Funny or Die was also the Wild West back then, right? Like they were putting out so many short films, and they would basically give you a small amount of money to make almost anything if you had a visible face that you could put into it. Mm-hmm. And I think what I learned from Funny or Die was one was the like power of celebrity or like visible actors, like what that could afford you, and like in the ways that it could open doors or allow things to get made. There was also like nothing was precious, right? Like it was quick turnaround. It was make things, figure out what works, less is more, and make. And I'm sure there was a reason for that on their end. Like maybe it was ad revenue or however their website was working at the time. But there was a real opportunity to just create, and things didn't need to be perfect. They just needed to be fun and quirky and weird. And that was also very freeing. And you know, again, if you had access to somebody known, you could get things made. So what I would do with it back then was you could sort of play these two things off each other. And I'm so sorry, like everybody at Funny or Die, if somebody ever hears this, but like you knew that Funny or Die could give you like $3,000 to $5,000 with which to get some insurance or pay your insurance premium on your production company policy, rent some equipment, food, crafty, maybe nothing had permits. It was the Wild West. Mm-hmm. But what I would do is you would go to Funny or Die and you would say like, oh, I've got access to Jean-Claude Van Damme, and we want to do this short where he I never got to do this short, but like I thought about this endlessly, where he would come warm up your partner, like by being like sexy man. And then it was like foreplay, but he would then hand your partner off to you. And I think this is the idea. And like, and then, you know, and then you could take over, right? Like he was sort of the opening act. And concurrently to pitching Funny or Die, being like, I've got access to Jean-Claude Van Damme and he wants to do this short, you would then try to get a hold of Jean-Claude Van Damme's management or representation and be like, Funny or Die's got $3,000 to $5,000. We can go make this great comedy sketch. And at the time, actors wanted material out there as well, right? They were looking to do things that were freeing, that were quick, immediate. They had a sketch. They could do something like Down and Dirty again, the Wild West version of this. And so everybody I knew back then was trying to do some form of this. Like, how can we make things? How can we make things quickly and not belabor it, not overthink it? And you learn a lot making things quickly and having a forum where people can watch them and engage with them, and you find out what's working and what's not working. And so very, very rad time making all the weird Funny or Die stuff back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the other thing, is a place to watch them. Again, you have, you know, today Vimeo or even YouTube to a certain extent. But I do think that there was this weird kind of fun moment where everything was, I won't say everything was possible, but lots of things felt possible. And Funny or Die kind of encapsulated that. All right, so let's move on. You make this documentary with Amanda Knox. You go to them and say, "I made the Dave Franco shorts. They're a little bit rude, but I can do it." What was making a documentary for Netflix like? In terms of the, I'm sure there's more money involved. Like there's a higher profile here. Amanda Knox is a very controversial figure, but also, you know, kind of a misunderstood figure in our culture. What was making that like, and what was interacting with her like, and trying to bring her story to the screen like?
Yeah, I mean, so at first Netflix was not involved, like truly, like, so I started making that film, I think, in 2011, right? Amanda was about to move through her first appeals trial. At that point, she'd been in prison for almost 4 years. And I had been afforded a random introduction to her. Some of her friends and some of her family. I kept thinking to myself at the time, after having read a Vanity Fair piece that had maybe come out in 2010, I can't remember the journalist who wrote it. It's a remarkable piece, but the piece of journalism was such that what was highlighting the fact that there had already been somebody found guilty and was in prison of all of the things Amanda had been charged and convicted with. And it didn't matter one bit. It didn't matter one bit relative to the justice process in Italy. And it certainly didn't matter one bit in the way that the story was being covered and talked about in the news media and what was quickly becoming like armchair quarterback true crime culture online and clickbait culture. And so I kept thinking to myself, how is it possible that we're living in a time where here are objective facts and they don't mean anything? I went and showed them all some Dave Franco not safe for work things, but also I was just really honest and open about who I was and my intentions and what I wanted to do as a filmmaker. And so I met Amanda and I guess I didn't meet her until she was released from prison that fall. But I was there at that appeals trial when she was acquitted and when she left to come back to the United States. And I went ahead and met her that fall. I went up to Seattle from Los Angeles. And I'm actually realizing right now, this is so off topic, but there's another Nathaniel Rateliff connection here. Is that like I took Amanda to see her first concert after she'd gotten out of, after she come back to the United States, and we went down to Portland, Oregon, and watched Nathaniel Rateliff open for Mumford and Sons. I remember the paparazzi followed us down, and there were all these pictures the next day of us at a roadside rest stop. We'd gone to eat pizza, and then there were like long lens telephoto images of us like side stage, like, because I was talking to Nathaniel and his band, who were all friends of mine. Weird that I keep coming back to Nathaniel. There's actually a Nathaniel Rateliff connection to Blood for Dust. Like, not that this is like the Nathaniel Rateliff like news hour, but like there's actually a Nathaniel Rateliff connection to Blood for Dust, which is like random. But at the time, so I started working on this documentary, and you start trying to, you have an idea about what the story is, the way you're going to tell the story, and you start putting together, you know, a pitch a pitch deck, a lookbook, and I started filming things that would go into a sizzle reel or like a show reel of what the approach and the tone and the style of the documentary would be. And then there was a process of like starting to try to film interviews, which took several years until I was able to start filming them. And then you put together another rip reel another pitch reel. And really every network and every streamer passed on the documentary except for Netflix. And then Netflix came on board and their financing starting from like 2014 through 2016 is really what allowed the project to exist, because at that point, you know, we'd all been putting our own money and our own sweat equity into the project and didn't know if anything would ever come from it. So really, Netflix became an incredible partner. And back then there wasn't this like this insane volume of, you know, true crime that feels like an AI just watched every quote unquote true crime documentary and then made the like AI version of that. I feel like the things I watch, like it just feels like a computer learned how to make Netflix content, and not even films. Like they just learned how to make Netflix content. And that's not a knock on Netflix. I think it's a knock on like just the fact that people are making things that are very form or like that feel the same over and over again. But at the time there wasn't a lot of true crime. I mean, I think Making a Murderer and then everything Joe Berlinger had been doing for PBS and had struggled to do for so long. Like there just wasn't a lot of precedent in the true crime space. And frankly, I think about this often, like it maybe came up once that someone said, hey, I wonder if there could be a two-part series here, right? Because I think Making a Murderer had, I can't remember how many parts it had. But other than that, it was really just like, hey, this is a documentary. This is going to fit into a tight 85 minutes. It's the best way to tell this story is to have it exist in this format. And really the idea of an entertaining, contained, pretty fast-moving documentary was also a meta reflection of the way that the story had been turned into entertainment and commodified, or at least Manda's story and the story around Meredith Kircher's murder and Rudy Gadea, the man who'd committed the crimes. And like the whole thing had been turned into entertainment. So it felt, and it, to me, it was like very important to try to figure out an entertaining way to package it up. Because again, it felt like a mirror to the story and to the, you know, to the experience of that people had engaging with that story. But Netflix was awesome. And, film wouldn't exist without them. Gosh, that's a long story, Sonny. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm in the zone.
I like long stories. No, I, Amanda Knox is fascinating, too, because she's very vocal on social media about having lost control of her story in a certain way, particularly in the way in the fictionalized versions of how it has been told. You know, she'll see somebody talk about how a story was inspired by Amanda Knox, and it's almost always somebody who did it and kind of got away with it. And she's like, this is not, you stop saying it's inspired by me. So it's interesting to think about the documentary as a way of her getting the real story out there.
It's interesting. Everybody actually who participated in the documentary, so all the subjects who were at the heart of the story, right? So there were not pundits or, you know, there were outside people weighing in, but that was, it all came from other media and other sources that, I could find. But really the subjects at the heart of the film were all the people that were living inside of this story that had been told up them and about the case. And every single one of them actually had the same reaction, which is nobody's heard me and what I have to say about who I am. They all felt like they'd been turned into caricatures they'd had these stories told about them that weren't true and that they had become ideas that people had. And they all wanted to do the same thing, which was to talk about their experience and their reality of what it was like to be at the heart of the story. So that was the prosecutor who had prosecuted Amanda and Raffaele. It was Raffaele Sollecito, Amanda's co-defendant at the time. It was the DNA experts. It was this journalist, Nick Pisa, who stood in for a lot of the tabloid culture and journalist culture that existed around the story and trial at the time. Everybody... It was fascinating to me. Everybody had the same reaction. Like nobody's heard who I really am. And granted, I don't think any of them had their stories like taken from them or turned into other entertainment or money opportunities in the way that Amanda did. But yeah, I mean, I it's interesting. Like I do know that she talks about that, and it's and right now it's like she and her partner Chris, who's a novelist and an author, and they have a podcast. They've figured out a way to take authorship and agency over her experience as it relates to a fiction adaptation that's about to happen with Hulu. They've got a great team of showrunners. I think they have Margaret Qualley playing Amanda Knox, mm-hmm. and I really think that for her, I don't want to speak for her, but I think I think it's remarkable that she's been able to find that agency to be able to do something on her own. I mean, I guess like why wouldn't you want to do that versus having the stories people tell about you be the thing they think they know is true about you. I guess I would applaud anybody that has the ability to do that and like the wherewithal to go through with that.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to slightly less weighty conversation. So earlier this year, and I'm ambushing you slightly here. I'm not intentionally ambushing you. I just didn't mention this at all in the pre-talk. But a movie came out called Night Swim, which you originated, I believe, as a short film that you made. With your partner from The Funny or Dies. Now, you did not write the screenplay. You did not direct this. So if you don't have anything to talk about here, we can move on to the next thing. It's not a problem.
I'm happy to talk about Night Swim.
but Night Swim's a fascinating movie.
Not be offended. Like, say it.
Like I'm talking down. But it was much better than I expected it to be. I was like, okay, movie pool kills people. Okay, this is the trailer did not inspire a lot of confidence. But I watched it at home this week to prepare for this, and I was like, oh, this is actually really good. I'm sorry. This comes across as very.
I'm not offended.
I want to talk about the making of this because it's this interesting. It starts as a short film. It's in a horror anthology, and then how did you guys spin that out into a feature? I mean, did you just go to the studios and say, hey, we got this idea, we got more ideas for it? I mean, what was the process there?
We put on those sandwich boards and we walked around Burbank where it says like eat more at Joe's, and I was like, we have short film, we'll sell for feature film adaptation. I met this incredible filmmaker and one of my dear friends, one of our dear friends, Bryce McGuire, in Los Angeles when I lived there. And he's not who I made the Funny or Die short films with, but Bryce and I had like, we met through our wives, actually. Our wives met. And in 2014, this goes back to maybe the first question you're asking about, like, how do you make things, or like, why are you making the things you're making, and how do you choose what to make? We had actually seen in 2014 that scary short films were doing well on the internet. And I love genre movies, right? Like Terminator 2, The Abyss, Blade Runner, Alien. Like, and Bryce loves, I guess I would say like The Night of the Hunter Stephen King adaptations and Halloween. So we had these overlapping interests, and we had seen that like people who had made horror short films that went viral were able to turn those films into feature adaptations, or it seemed like it was starting to happen. So we thought like, man, we want some of that. Like every filmmaker is trying to find a way to make a movie. So making a short film was a low cost way to prove a style, an identity, a concept, a tone. We didn't even really have, we actually had no story. And, you know, I'm sure if Universal or Bryce, I don't know what the PR position is on this, but like we made a short film in Michelle Branch, the pop star's backyard at the time. She had a house in Toluca Lake. I was going to move to New York with my wife so she could go to law school. We had access to this pool. We dreamed up this short film. We made it. It had no story. It was just a scary thing. It was to establish tone. And then it sat there and it did well on the internet and people liked it, but nobody came calling to ask us to turn it into a feature film. Cut to a couple of years later, Bryce and I were like slogging it out as filmmakers do. We're trying to find our way. I think I'd been working on the documentary and making this other like independent feature. Bryce came to me one day and said, man, like I would love to adapt or find a feature film to adapt out of this. Like, let's start coming up with ideas. So we literally sat down at my house in Nashville, Tennessee. I think it was at the end of 17 or 18. And we mapped out a feature film and a feature film pitch. And we had to write mythology from the beginning. And really, like, the mythology was like the idea of like making a deal with the devil and the things that you do to like making a deal with an entity or a devil to regain your virility and to get back on top again. And then the cost that comes from that. So we mapped out this film. We eventually did like a studio, Warner Brothers and Atomic Monster optioned it. And then nothing happened. It sat there for a long time. But Bryce is truly like not just a great filmmaker, but an incredible hustler. And he found a way to get Blumhouse to see it. And at the same time, I think Blumhouse and Atomic Monster is two horror specific or like horror focused companies were starting to partner behind the scenes. And they realized there was a way to extract the film from Warner Brothers / New Line / where Atomic Monster had been and put it under the Universal umbrella. And then at that point, like my job was just to support Bryce in the making of the film. Now, and you know, they made the film, they went into production at the beginning of last year. So in the beginning of 2023, and then, you know, and the film came out in January of this year of 2024. And I, you know, through Bryce and through talking to all the other executives at Atomic Monster and Blumhouse, I got to see how the sausage got made. And it's like, I'm both incredibly proud of it. And I feel like it's been probably destroyed critically for reasons that like, I feel like people wanted so much more, but at the same time, it's made Universal so much money. And I think about that and I go, man, this is an incredibly hard thing to do, is to make a successful film that generates, I think it's like probably $55 million at the box office thus far. And now it's on demand. And so I have to applaud Bryce at every step for both like for like not giving up on it and doing everything he could to make a great film and to get it out there in the world. That's hard to do. It's hard to do at the studio level. So thank you for watching it. Thank you for the kind words. Yeah. I'm not offended at all by wondering if it's going to be any good. It's a haunted pool movie. No. What could it possibly be? I think like we did our best, you know.
It's certainly, I mean, look, it's certainly elevated by the performances. Wyatt Russell is fantastic. He's really good. And Carrie Condon, who I've loved forever. And I'm glad people are really starting to, I feel like people are finally starting to give her more credit after The Banshees of Inisherin. And also this, I mean, lots of people were saying nice things, but look, I'll make my real quick pitch to people if this has intrigued them. It reminded me a bit of The Shining in the sense of that that idea of a dad who swayed by a dark force living in the house to you know, do things for himself at the expense of his family. I'll leave it at that. But folks should check it out. I mean, again, it's interesting. It is better. It is better than the reviews suggest.
So that was actually the original treatment. The original film that we wrote like had what basically was The Shining. We had also originally written like what I would call like the A24 very dark version of the film, right? Like, and specifically like there was a condemnation of this man who was willing to sacrifice and harm and hurt his family, in this selfish way, right? So that he could get back on top. It was dark. It was messed up. I mean, you know, the film as it exists now is a PG-13 wide release version of that story. And it was fascinating to watch the to work on the evolution of it and watch it evolve as different people got involved and it realized it wasn't going to be the, you know, that very grounded, dark, messed up horror version of it, that it was going to be a more commercially available version of it. I mean, it's been, an incredible process. I mean, Stephen King watched it like a couple weeks ago or a month ago and tweeted about it. And as someone who grew up without a television reading, you know, Stephen King books and scaring myself to death, like that, you know, it's such a damn cool thing. You make a movie like that, you learn a lot, you learn what not to do, you learn what you can do better, and then you try to do it again.
Yeah. All right. So let's move. I'm sorry. Finally, we're going to get to Blood for Dust here. This is the reason we scheduled this. So Blood for Dust. Let's talk about. All right. I just want to know how what inspired you to write this and make it. I mean, it's an interestingly specific movie in both location, in the professions of the people involved. Like there were things, you know, so I'll let you give folks the elevator pitch here in a second. But I am fascinated by the specificity of it as much as anything else, because that is where you get memorable movies of this sort. It's not you don't want the kind of mush generic whatever. These feel like real people with real jobs and real problems, and that's what makes it interesting. So Blood for Dust, give folks what's the synopsis? Tell people what they're getting themselves into here.
Blood for Dust is the story of one man trying to figure out how to take care of his family and considering all the things he could do that might not be the right thing to do to do just that. I mean, I guess more specifically, it's about a traveling salesman who has a sick son, and he and his wife are the sick son's decline in health has sort of driven them apart, and they're trying to make ends meet. And this main character, Cliff, played by Scoot McNairy, runs into an old colleague who he used to do some bad things with and decides he's maybe going to do some bad things again, but he justifies it as a means to an end. And that's probably not even the best pitch of it, but the best breakdown of it. But the film came from this like deep love of John Steinbeck and East of Eden. And also kind of realizing in my own life and in my own path that being good, being a good person, doing good work seems to almost mean next to nothing anymore. And I don't say that in a nihilistic, like bleak way. But I think like from East of Eden, like I've truly always been struck by this idea that, and this is also true about Steinbeck generally, who like believed that we are all lumbering beasts yearning to be free, that we are pigs who can fly, right? And that was even the Latin inscription on the inside of all of his books was the Latin phrase ad astra per alia porci, and he had a flying pegasus and to the stars on the wings of a pig, right? That we are earthbound animals who believe that it's possible that we can transcend what we are cast as. And I've always, in my own life and in my own time as a human being, as a father, as a husband, as a friend, like have thought about that as I've, you know, sometimes wonder about the choices I've made, the people I've associated with, the reasons why I've done things, is like constantly trying to be better and constantly being aware that like I am not just the bad choices I've made or the bad things that I've done. And I say bad, like I'm not talking about criminal, but I'm saying like emotional the terrible emotional things or self detrimental. I'm not sure what the right word is here. The things that I've done that maybe have hurt others. So I've thought a lot about that. And then I've concurrently thought about like, man, the playing field out there is not level. And in my experience, just in making movies, I've come to realize that that's the case. It's like, you can be really great at what you do. You can be a great filmmaker and it doesn't seem to make a lick of difference. Like it's almost like it's completely irrelevant. And I've started looking holistically then at all these people that I've known growing up in a small town in upstate New York. I mean, we live in Nashville, Tennessee. And I think a lot of people look at those who are getting ahead and they go, man, they're not clean, right? And they start to wonder what if I do some of that, right? And so there's this synthesis of these things that I've been like thinking about and going through. And we wrote this character that's a traveling salesman played by Scoot McNairy, which is a metaphorical approximation of what I do as a filmmaker, which is like wander around like as the odd duck out, trying to convince people to buy what I'm selling, which are my ideas and these things that I need to peddle. They're the way, I mean, I'm peddling them because they're both what I do believe in the product I'm selling, and I want people to buy it so that I can make a living, so that I can take care of my family. So again, there's this is where the film came from. It's like looking at all these three things and going, man, there's a story here, and there's also like this piece of commentary about like the working class and those that come from nothing and the risks and the things they're trying to do or willing to do to get ahead or to get their family ahead. And even if it's misguided, that it's not, they're not all in on it, that it's just a struggle that I think a lot of people go through, and it's a very relatable struggle. Hopefully most people won't end up running drugs through Montana and ending up in gunfights. But I do think that, like, metaphorically, the struggle is something that a lot of people could relate to. So, and I found that, like, after talking about this idea and then starting to map out the story with my writing partner, David Ebeltoft, who wrote the screenplay and we wrote the story together, like, we really found that a lot of it resonated with a lot of people. So this, and the specificity of it was, like, very, like, available. And I think, too, trying to make a movie for folks that just aren't on the coasts was very important. Yes, we would make a movie that, like, had all the craft and the artistry of movies that people in cinema towns and in New York and Los Angeles would love. But it was a story about just an average person, an average American going through life.
Yeah, and the film played at Tribeca, which of course is a big, you know, coastal festival, but it is, I mean, it is the sort of thing that you don't, or it's set in the sort of place you don't see a lot anymore, though I guess more so now with the success of things like Yellowstone and whatever. I feel like that part of the country is getting a little more attention these days.
Yeah, so funny enough, the film was originally set in Texas, and it was set in a hot Texas summer, and we were going to film in Montana, set as tech, standing in for Texas. And then because of the actor's schedule, we had to move production into early winter. And we realized there's no way a freezing cold wind, you know, snow drifted, windy Montana was going to be a hot Texas summer. And we started doing some research, and we figured out that back in the early 90s, Montana was really like where the drug trade moving from the southern United States up to Canada was moving through. And some of that was because Montana was still the Wild West in some ways. It was, heck, there was no speed limit in Montana until the early 2000s. There was a lot of money in Montana. There was a lot of oil rights, mineral rights, and don't tread on me mentality there, and still is really to this day. And so we realized very quickly we could actually just transpose the story to be set in the Northwest, or, you know, and make a what we joked as a Northwestern. But that it was also like an apt place, and it was a place that didn't have stories told about it like this. Yeah, there's movies like Wind River, there's Yellowstone, but there really has, and yes, there's Fargo that's set in the snow, but like there aren't a lot of other snowy climate, freezing cold crime thrillers that we could come up with. Funny enough, like, the French word for crime thriller, I think, is polar, and it seems very apt that, like, we in France, our film's about to play at a film festival, or has played, that programs only crime thrillers, and it's very funny to me that we're called a polar film, because we are a polar film. It's very cold, but the cold in Montana became a character in the movie, and it really mirrored the protagonist, played by Scoot McNairy, his reality, which was that, like, he could get no relief. There was no break from the pressures that he was feeling. He was always cold. It could never get warm enough. And we found that really actually brought the movie alive on set and visibly on screen. Like, you can feel the snow. You can feel the cold. You can see people's breath. And it's just an awesome character that, yeah, like you said, I haven't seen very much.
Yeah, let's talk about actually getting this film made, because it is always a struggle. I am always fascinated to hear how folks manage to cobble together the resources to get something like this made. Because if you don't feel comfortable saying, I'm just curious about how much. What are we looking at in terms of budget for this?
Well, under $5 million.
Okay. So,
not a lot of money, but like, it's still a lot of money to me, right? Like, relative to the movie experience.
Right. Exactly. So it's cheap by Hollywood standards. It's still a ton of money. I mean, like, getting together the amount of money to shoot something like this is not easy. So when you went out fundraising, how did you raise the money? That's a very basic question. How did you get folks to invest?
So this film is a debt-driven model, right? So it's we found a sales company, and they pre-sold territories based on the perceived value of our package, right? So that means me as a director my producing partner Noah and our company Witchcraft, and the three primary actors in the movies, Scoot McNairy, Kit Harington, and Josh Lucas, and you, all these various European territories and North America say, hey, we're based on this package, we're going to, this film is worth X amount of dollars to us. And that number is the most conservative amount of money that they could, they think they could possibly make back. And then you go to these non-traditional lenders, or, you know, you could go to, I mean, you go to anybody that has money, but it's less risky as far as money being spent than straight equity, because it's a loan against papered value. And then you borrow that money, and you borrow money in cascading loans. So you start with the smallest loan because you owe interest on it, and then you take your senior loan right before probably day one of photography, if I remember correctly, and then you work really quickly to get the film done and hand it to the distributor, because the distributor in our case, like the Avenue / Highland Film Group, is going to pay back the primary lender of the money we borrowed to make the movie. So it's a model that, you know, people talk in the film industry about foreign pre-sales, and foreign pre-sales are name driven, like perceived value driven. Back when it was just Scoot McNairy, who was has been an actor I've wanted to work with since I first saw him in this incredible movie called The Off Hours back in 2011. But Scoot was the very first actor to come to this project back in, I think probably officially in the fall of 2020. And I guess maybe we've been talking about it since 2019 or maybe 18. I can't remember. Back then people were saying, this movie, there's no way you're going to be able to make this movie. Like here's, you know, $750,000 because Scoot has no value, which blew my mind. Because Scoot's such a remarkable actor, but I guess I understand, you know, I don't know, the debt driven model is not like looking at people's qualities or skill sets as an actor, or they're focused on different things. To Scoot's, like, and maybe I should never say this out loud, but I'm still going to say this out loud because I think it says so much about who Scoot is. Scoot offered at one point to play the role of Ricky if it allowed the film to cast a more famous person in the role of Cliff. And he just wanted the movie to get made, and he wanted to be in the movie. And I don't know if he was saying that to be nice to me. I don't know what the reason was, but I kept saying, I was like, man, that's an incredible gesture, right? He kept thinking, if there's if there's somebody else in the lead role, maybe we'll be able to get more money and it'll be easier to make. And I always found stuck with me, like that he thought of that at all. And I've probably never told anybody that. I've never told Kit Harington that. I've never told anybody that. But I think it just goes to show like how rad Scoot is as a person, which nobody would know from watching the movie. They just might go, man, that's an incredible actor who also is the everyman. Like, I feel like I've seen him in a lot of things, but I don't know who he is. And he's really good. But he doesn't call attention to himself. Like, who is that guy? The movie gets made this way. And it's a tough way to make a movie, I will say.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. And Scoot McNairy is great. I mean, if folks might remember him from Monsters, which was kind of a indie hit a few years back, kind of a I don't even know how to describe it. Not quite found footage kaiju movie, but in that vein. But I may edit this out. I don't, this may be a rude question. Here's how I would phrase it. Is Kit Harington, star of Game of Thrones, who's been in you know, TV shows, movies and stuff, is he a bigger sale for foreign audiences than Scoot McNairy? I feel like that would be.
Oh yeah, I mean, yes, I mean, like, without a doubt. Like, I mean, we would not have got the money we got to make them, or, you know, we were able to find, or, you know, sell against without Josh Lucas or Kit. And then, strangely, I actually feel like it was. Just like thinking back about the process, I think it was Josh Lucas's involvement that really started to unlock some possibilities there. And I don't know, maybe they know this, maybe they don't. I mean, it's always interesting. Like, sometimes I see lists go around Hollywood or come to us from different companies of like what people have value as it relates to borrowed money. And I look at that, those lists, and I go, this makes no sense. Like, and also it's like, the straight commodification of like somebody is like, it's also arbitrary because it's like, I don't know. It's so bizarre. But yeah, I mean, again, I think Kit had something to do with that. Again, but I think it was the package as opposed to like just one of them. I think it was all three of them. And you know, Josh and Kit were, I mean, they liked me enough, I guess, and they liked the project enough. They also loved Scoot as an actor and wanted to work with him and wanted to be in a movie with him. And that, you know, I would be lying if I didn't say that that was part of their, or at least the way I understood it, their reason. They were, you know, in on the idea, in on me, in on what I wanted to do, but they were also in on wanting to make a movie with Scoot. And I think I kept thinking to myself, that has immeasurable value, right? Like the fact that Scoot is in this movie already is allowing this other thing to happen, but no one making these pre-sales or these debt-driven calculations can take that into consideration. Scoot is, I heard once somebody say, like, Scoot is in the incoming call business. Everybody calls him directly. Like, Scoot is so reliable, so great, such a wonderful human being that people call him up and they just put him in everything, right? Like Ben Affleck calls him up. Like, I feel like he couldn't do a Michael Keaton film because he did Blood for Dust, but like Michael Keaton was directing a movie and just called him up. Like, people just call him up. Scoot texted me the other day. We were talking about another project. He mentioned my name. Or he told another writer and producer that he would be in their movie if I directed it. And I was blown away by this. He texted me saying like, hey, I'm having your agent send you this project. And we got to talking and he's like, and then he mentioned something about, he's like, yeah, I got to go to New York City for a day job. He's like, I got to go do some work. Like, you know, it's busy times. He's like, there's hay to make. It's light out. So, you know, I'll go make the hay. And then like the next day I saw a Deadline article, like he's in the James Mangold Bob Dylan biopic with Timothy Chalamet. I texted him the link and I was like, is this your day job? He's like, yeah, man, it's pretty wild out here. I'm like, only you, Scoot McNairy, would tell me that like the day job you've taken in New York City, you make it sound like you're, I don't know, making bagels or something for like 24 hours. Only you would describe being the new in James, this massive James Mangold film that I'm sure is going to be awesome and rad as a day job. But that's Scoot McNairy, and that has value to other people. It has a lot of value to me, who, you know, to the debt-driven model, who knows?
Yeah. No. Yeah. The whole thing is fascinating. Just breaking down who can sell tickets, who can drive VOD sales, and I, you know, to bring it back to what we were discussing earlier about Funny or Die and having faces to, if you've got a famous person, you can get a little money. This has always been my theory on the Netflix model. Is that this is where the star driven movie is going, because people throw on Netflix and they are looking at the home screen and they're like, oh, I recognize that guy's face. I'll watch this for 5 minutes and see if it's good.
But then you watch it just for 5 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you're like, it's probably
right,
not that good.
All right, Scoot McNairy is great, by the way, everyone. I really enjoy this movie, one of the big reasons I like it is because the cast is amazing. Your casting director did a fantastic job,
which was just us. We just casted ourselves, by the way. I want to point that out, like, okay. Thank you.
Cheers to you, because sometimes I like to describe movies as being filled with faces I like to see, and this is one of them. I mean, Kit Harington and Scoot McNairy and Josh Lucas, who we haven't even talked about really, they're all great. But also, Stephen Dorff is in this for a scene. Do you just have Stephen Dorff's number? Do you just call him up and say, hey, we need you in Montana for a day. Can you do it?
Essentially, yes. But like, there's a little bit of backstory to this, which is great. Like, so again, I met Scoot after years of trying to meet Scoot, one day Scoot says to me, I don't know if it's like 2019 or 2020. He says to me, hey man, like you ever run into Stephen Dorff down there in Nashville? And I'm like, well, like I know, like I don't run into Stephen Dorff down here in Nashville. I didn't even know he lived here. But it turned out that like, and Stephen has a strong family connection to Nashville. His father is a very well-known songwriter, and Stephen has a tragic connection to Nashville as well, that I believe his brother passed away tragically here. But Stephen had moved here, I don't know if it was in 2020 or 2021, and I don't remember the dates exactly, but Scoot says like, man, you guys would really get along. We did this show together, True Detective season 3. We rode motorcycles. Like, I really, you know, you got you get you guys got to hang out. And I would be like, how do you, sure. Like, how do I hang out with Stephen Dorff? Like, true legend, right? Like true cinema legend. So I took a risk and I emailed, Stephen's longtime agent, who is now his manager. I said, hey, you don't know me. I'm just some Joe off the street. But, Scoot McNairy, who's friends with Stephen Dorff, told me Stephen lives here in town and that he'd probably like me and maybe we could make a movie together. I was thinking I need to follow through on this for Scoot. Like, maybe I need to show Scoot that it's possible that I will run into Stephen Dorff. So I send this email out into the ether. I barely remember when I sent it, didn't hear anything back. And then in April of 2022, almost 2 years ago exactly. So it was April 20th, and I remember this because it was the day my second daughter was born. My wife and I were in the C-section recovery unit at Vanderbilt. And at this point, literally my wife had given birth to our second daughter maybe 45 minutes prior. And my cell phone rings and it says no caller ID. And my wife says, oh, you should answer that. Like, sometimes the midwives, their number comes up as no caller ID. And I was like, are you sure you want me to answer this? Like, we're having like a lot, we're going through some stuff right now. Yeah. And she says, no, just answer it. So I answer the phone and it's just, there's like, it's almost like it, to me, in my memory, it's like Tyler Durden in Fight Club, like just chewing crackers or something in the background. And he goes, Rod, it's Dorff. And I go, wait, who, what? And it took me a minute because I'm not in that zone, right? I'm not in that zone of like, and I go, whoa, I'm like, all right, like, hey, Steven, I'm so stoked to be like talking to you. Like, thank you for giving me a call. I'm going to have to call you back. Right. And it was like, there was, and the crazy part about this is just the day before I had met Kit Harington over a Zoom. He had read half of the script and wanted to meet. And so And then my daughter was born on that same day, Dorff called me. So there was like this 3 days of like life changing things. And like one was very important. And one, I mean, I guess making a movie of this caliber and this like visibility is like life changing too. But so that Stephen and I eventually, like, we went, I drove out to his part of town. We met at we went and got gas station sandwiches and drove his quad around. Like, and we went up to his property and like hung out. Eventually my wife and I went out there and went to a big bonfire party and we just became friends. And he likes Scoot a lot, right? Like they had a great experience making True Detective. So I told him, I was like, hey man, we're going to go make this movie later this year, in Montana. Like, will you be in it? And he's like, yeah. He's like, dude, whatever you need. Like, and so literally he came to Montana for one day. He's in one scene. But I also think it, like, that's just who Stephen Dorff is. Like, he shows up for his friends and he's incredible and he just elevates everything he's in. And why wouldn't I call him? We talk all the time. Like, I'm all the time asking him if he'll do small random things or if he'd like, or even big things. Like, it's not just about like a cameo, but yeah, just that's how you get Stephen Dorff is, you know, life happens to you.
Yeah, that's awesome. No, again, I love Stephen Dorff. I love that third season of True Detective.
Same.
He's so good in it. Him and Mahershala Ali.
They really are. They're incredible. Yeah.
All right. And then the last person I will ask you to gush about, or maybe not, is Ethan Suplee, who I love, who I have loved since Mallrats. I mean, literally was, you know, renting that movie 5 times a year from Blockbuster back in 94, 95, whenever it finally came out on VHS. I love it when he pops up in things, and here he's got a nice meaty supporting role. How was it like working with Ethan Suplee?
Ethan is the best. Actually, we were just talking this morning because we're making a new movie together very shortly now that he's going to be in, and but I met Ethan on the internet, like, Ethan remembers everything. His energy is incredible. His like love of movies, his love of people, his like, his self-awareness is remarkable. But, you know, this is, I don't even know again what year it was. Maybe it was like 18, 19, 20. I think like I wrote him a Twitter direct message truly about another movie I wanted to make. And maybe we had liked some of the same things. Maybe we'd been, I don't know. Twitter was a different place back then, and it felt like a little much more open, and people were talking about things. But Ethan took a chance and wrote me back, and then that transitioned into him giving me, you know, he's like, yeah, send me an email, and then it's like, hey, just call me, like, let's just talk about this, and now, like, I called him up 2 weeks ago, legitimately. I mean, we talk all the time. We talk enough now, like frequently, I should say. And about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I called him and I was like, hey, Ethan, I have a new movie. I want you to be in it. And he said, say no more. He's like, I'll be in the movie. You don't even have to tell me what it is. And we have another movie or two we're trying to make that, like, we can't find the money for. But this movie has the money we need. And it was very emotional to hear, to have somebody of his, like, experience and portfolio say unequivocally, like, I'll be in whatever movie you ask me to be in. It doesn't even matter what the role is. Like, I felt so seen as a filmmaker and as a collaborator. And that just is who he is. And I too, like, love him so much. And I also love the thing I love about Ethan, which I also loved about Kit Harington in this movie, is the ability to have people be the things that they are not, that people aren't just stuck in a box. And this goes back to the Funny or Die thing, is that, like, every creative person that I know has very different interests and motivations and things they want to do. They are not just one thing. And I think that, and what I found is that most artists are that way. Right? Like, even Kit Harington wanted to do this project because it was so drastically different and had nothing to do with valor and honor. It was antithetical to that in so many ways. And he felt like he'd been offered so many of the same roles, or he said this to me, like, everything felt like it was, like, the same note over and over again. And I think with Ethan, like, I just see him as a mirror to some humanity that's very authentic and relatable, no matter what the character is, who he is. And I want that in every movie I make. I want that energy. I want that enthusiasm. I want that. And, like, it doesn't matter whether it's a horror movie, a comedy, a crime thriller, a genre movie. Like, and the same with Stephen Dorff. Stephen Dorff is an incredible comedian, actually. And he's on the latest season of Righteous Gemstones. I think he's in the new season. He's an incredibly funny guy, but people know him as, you know, this guy or that guy. And it's like, man, we are all not just one thing. Right. And so I know that to be true about Ethan. And I love the man, and I want to make many, many movies with him. And I too love it when he pops up in things. He's one of the best parts in my mind of Damien Chazelle's movie Babylon. He pops up in the end of Babylon. And I love him so much for that.
Yeah. I loved him in that. And he was in, God is a Bullet, the other
Cassavetes
thing I saw him
movie,
in
that right?
relatively. Yeah. The new Nick Cassavetes, came out, I think it came out last year. Or maybe it was a year before that, but he plays a heavy, a Satanist drug runner. I mean, it's different and it's interesting. And I, am always excited to see him pop up, which again, he's great in this movie.
My dream is to make movies with my friends and people I like. And so I'm going to call all of these guys indiscriminately. And, like, everyone I've ever worked with or known, it's like, and that's the way you make a movie now, right? Is you don't worry about the gatekeepers. You don't worry about what the people that are putting price tags on someone's foreign sales value are. You call up the people you know and like and want to be in the trenches with, and you say, hey, I've got this thing. Can we, and the minute you find that, like, that energy and that synergy around something between creative souls, like, it's much easier to then to show people that the gatekeepers and the people that have access to money that, like, hey, there's something here. There's all these disparate, wonderful, weird artists that are, like, coming together. They're coalescing around this idea. There's a spark there. There's something there that we need to, like, add fuel to. And so again, I'm going to call all these guys, and everybody else I work with in the future is just going to be like, hey man, let's go into the woods and make a movie, which is what I would have done as a kid if I had a video camera. But I think a lot of people did it as a kid with a video camera. And I'm just, like, trying to be the, guy who's 43 years old and on doing the same thing. Whether I can find $100 million, it'll be the same ethos, the same approach. I'm going to call the same guys. Like, we actually have a movie right now called Die by Night with this incredible actress, Isabel Furman, and this British actor, mm-hmm. Ben Hardy. And there's all these other ancillary characters in it. And I literally, my producing partner, Noah, and I are just like, well, we're going to call Dorf for that. We're going to call Supley for that. We're going to call Kit for that. And it's just like, well, I talked to Josh Lucas the other day about a project, and it's like, that's just, I don't know. You find these cool, awesome, good people who show up, who care, or kind, and you just want to do things again and again with them. And so that's just my approach to filmmaking now. Maybe it's the new Wild West for me. Like, it's the new version of Funny or Die, which is, I know this guy. I know this person. I'm gonna pull them in, and we're gonna go find the money to make it. And that's what I was doing, you know, to get started at Funny or Die.
Yeah, Isabel Furman from the Orphan movies.
She's in this new Kevin Costner Horizon, this like labor of love Western series that he's put together that has an insane cast. I truly believe Kevin Costner just like probably has a Rolodex that would rival. I mean, gosh, anybody who's a legend like that probably has an incredible Rolodex. He probably just called up all the people he likes and was like, hey, I want you to be in this movie. I want to be able to do that too. Granted, I think he put his own money into that series, but that's, oh man, I guess putting your money where your mouth is really, really, really the true test of something.
Yeah, that one, I'm excited for that one. I'm excited to see how it turns out, because we can always use, more big budget, big screen Westerns. That's a fun genre.
Agreed.
All right. We're running long here. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know about Blood for Dust, which is hitting theaters and VOD on Friday, April 19th. What should folks know that I did not ask?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Blood for Dust, it's a neo-noir, neo-Western crime thriller. If you like movies like Drive, Wind River, or maybe even like, you know, Wim Wenders films like Paris, Texas, or The American Friend, you'll probably like our film. It's also a weird art film. We joke that the trailer makes it look like Guns the movie. It's a slightly different movie than the trailer and the key art represent, but I think that the trailer will like allow our movie to reach a larger audience, and then hopefully they come for like the humanity and the approximations of real life that exist in the world, and real people that exist in the world. I'm grateful that anybody takes the time to watch anything. Everyone's drowning in choices, and you know, every filmmaker wants their work to be seen. So even if talking to you and people that are listening to this, like even if someone takes a chance in the movie, it means a great deal. Like, I know our time is valuable, and we have a lot of options. So thank you in advance to anybody who has the time to watch it. And of course, I hope that you like it. Or if you don't like it, I hope that you hate it. And that's okay too, because I'd rather have that than it be milquetoast and you think nothing at all and you forget about it. I'd rather have some visceral reaction to it. And I would take that over you know, the opposite.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. I think people will lean more towards love than hate this one, though. It's a, you know, everyone, I hear from lots of people who say, why do you, why is everything in Hollywood so boring? We don't get anything new or exciting. It's all, you know, CGI, superhero mush, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, look, you can find the stuff. It's out there. But you have to look for it. You have to get out there and look for it. And this is a movie worth looking for. So Blood for Dust, check it out. It's on VOD now. Probably a theatrical. It is playing in theaters. Yes,
it's a small number of theaters. Like I actually probably need to check my email and find out like when and where. But you know, it'll be on the digitally available starting April 19th, and then you know, as the days go by, like more and more, it'll start to be available more and more places. And you know, it's again, just grateful that it's out there. Grateful for the Avenue and Highland and all that they're doing to get the movie out there. Yeah, again, it's a very gritty, grounded movie. Real places, not a lot of CGI. Real locations, real people. Just a story of America, story of the myth of the American dream, and the lengths people are willing to go to try to make it.
Yeah. All right, Rod, thank you for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Sonny, thank you so much. I really appreciate this. Like, means a great deal.
My name, again, is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.